Good evening, everybody. Thank you all for coming to the temple tonight. My name is Krishna Presta Das, and hopefully we can discuss the Bhagavad Gita and all gain some inspiration from delving into this great ancient spiritual knowledge from ancient India. To first start, I would like to do an invocation prayer, which is at the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita. I will also be reading the Sanskrit and the translation, so hopefully we can all follow along and get into the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita. So, Om Ajana Timirandasya Jana Jana Salakaya Kaksu Militam Yena Tasme Shri Gurave Nama Shri Chaitanya Mano Bistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Savayam Rupa Kada Mayam Dadati Sava Padadam Tika. I was born in the darkest ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torch of knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. When will Srila Rupa Goswami Prabhupada, who has established within this material world the mission to fulfill the desire of Lord Chaitanya, give me shelter under his lotus feet? Bandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutapada Kamalam Sri Guran Vaishnavams Ka Sri Rupam Sagratam Sahagana Raghu Anatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Savetam Savadatum Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Visaham Vitamka. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of my spiritual master and unto the feet of all Vaishnavas. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of Srila Rupa Goswami along with his elder brother Sanatan Goswami, as well as Raghunatha Das and Raghunatha Bhatta, Gopala Bhatta, and Srila Jiva Goswami. I offer my respectful obeisances to Lord Krishna Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, along with Advaita Acharya, Gadadhara, Srivas, and other associates. I offer my respectful obeisances to Srimati Radharani and Sri Krishna, along with their associates Sri Lalita and Vaisakha. E Krishna Kudana Sindhu, Dina Bando Jagatpate, Gopes Gopika Kanta, Radha Kanta Namo Stute. O my dear Krishna, you are the friend of the distressed and the source of creation. You are the master of the gopis and the lover of Radharani. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. Tapta Kanchana Gurangi Radhe Vrinda Van Esvari Rishabuno Sute Devi Pranam Ami Hari Pri. I offer my respects to Radharani, whose bodily complexion is like molten gold, and who is the queen of Vrindavan. You are the daughter of King Vrishbhanu, and you are very dear to Lord Krishna. Vancha Kaupa Tarubayaska Kripa Sindubaya Evaka Patitanam Pavan Ebayo Vaishnavayo Namo Nama. I offer my respectful obeisances unto all the Vaishnava devotees of the Lord. They can fulfill the desires of everyone, just like desire trees, and they are full of compassion for the fallen souls. Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita, Gadadhara, Shivazadi, Gaura Bhaktavrinda. I offer my obeisances to Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita, Gadadhara, Shivazadi, and all the others in the line of devotion. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Please forgive me if my Sanskrit pronunciation isn't as great as perhaps it should be, but hopefully you can bear with me. So, one question to all of you guys. Who has read the Bhagavad Gita before? Okay, so about half and half. So I guess we should first try to understand what is the Bhagavad Gita. And for those of you that haven't read it in full, it's a literary gem from ancient India and forms a much larger text called the Mahabharata. And it was spoken about 5,000 years ago. So if the Mahabharata is considered one of the longest poems ever written, and just 700 verses, or 700 odd verses, form the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita is considered the essence of the Vedic teachings, just those 700 verses, but the Vedic teachings form part of a much larger scope of knowledge. However, Lord Krishna has been very kind and given us the condensed version of that knowledge so that we can access it and begin to assimilate its teachings. Basically, it's a discussion between the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, and his very personal friend, Arjuna. The contents of the conversation are initially based around Arjuna's indecisiveness to fight his kinsman in a great battle for the kingdom of Bharat. So this is why the Bhagavad Gita is just a small part of a larger volume of work with the Mahabharata. Due to Arjuna's indecisiveness, it resulted in Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, teaching Arjuna the system of Bhakti Yoga. And he did this primarily to re-establish its principles as a previous system that he had taught had been lost. So Lord Sri Krishna was instructing Arjuna for the benefit of everybody. So the questions that Arjuna asked to understand what Krishna was saying, we should always try and listen to. Because sometimes when you have a great depth of knowledge, not knowing the right questions to understand or to ask to understand that knowledge is an impediment in you being able to really conceptualize what's being talked about. So listening to Arjuna and his questions, we should really try to understand those. Essentially, Lord Krishna is teaching Bhakti Yoga, and what this enables a practitioner to do is devote their lives to the absolute truth. And once they've devoted their lives to the absolute truth, they can transform their consciousness to see the Lord face to face. And so this is obviously a system of yoga that needs to be practiced. During the course of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna delineates this philosophy and how to apply it to your life. And then, I think in the 12th chapter, he gives his friend Arjuna divine vision and reveals his universal form to show his dear friend that all of the infinite spiritual material nature is contained within him. So this is quite a profound understanding, a profound vision. But this is how Lord Krishna conclusively proves that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He delineates his philosophy, his Bhakti Yoga, and how we can approach him. And then, to avoid any misunderstanding, he shows Arjuna his universal form. So we should understand that when devotees of Krishna say that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna has given us that vision to perceive that, or at least theoretically. And this is a point that we should come from. So to comprehend the knowledge contained within the Bhagavad Gita, we should at least theoretically understand that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then, on that theoretical basis, we should then try and comprehend the Bhagavad Gita with the spirit of devotion. So this is another point, that to really go deeper and deeper into the knowledge that's presented, we should try and understand it with love and devotion, because that actually helps us come to grips with certain philosophical points and gives us a clearer understanding. So that's just the background to the Bhagavad Gita, for those of you that don't know, and for those of you that have read it, I hope it just reinforces the understanding that you have gained from that. So today we're at the temple and we're going to discuss one verse, one shloka from the Bhagavad Gita. And this verse is actually from the end of the Bhagavad Gita. So this is the 18th chapter. And this verse is 18.20, for those of you that would like to know. Just to summarize this chapter is called the conclusion, the perfection of renunciation. So Arjuna has already been through his indecisiveness. He's had lots of questions. Krishna's revealed his status, his divine status to him. And this is really the summarization of the whole work. And Krishna is explaining the meaning of renunciation and the effects of the modes of nature on human consciousness and activity, and the ultimate conclusion of the Gita. The highest path of religion is absolute, unconditional, loving surrender unto Lord Krishna, which frees one from all sins, brings one to complete enlightenment, and enables one to return to Krishna's eternal spiritual abode. So this is what the chapter, the knowledge that is contained within this chapter. So I'll read text 20. Sava bhutesu yenekam bhavam avyayam iksate avibhaktam vaibhakte esu taj janam vidhi sattvikam. Now the synonyms, so this is a direct translation of the Devanagari Sanskrit into English. So, sarva bhutasu, in all living entities, yena, by whom, ekam, one, bhavam, situation, avyayam, imperishable, iksate, does see, avibhaktam, undivided, vibhaktesu, in the numberless divided, tat, that, janam, knowledge, vidhi, no, sattvikam, in the mode of passion.
Goodness.
Sorry, in the mode of goodness. I should have worn my glasses. My apologies. Translation. That knowledge by which one undivided spiritual nature is seen in all existences, undivided in the divided, is knowledge in the mode of goodness. Srila Prabhupada's purport. A person who sees one spirit in every living being, whether a demigod, human being, animal, bird, beast, aquatic, or plant, possesses knowledge in the mode of goodness. In all living entities, one spirit soul is there, although they have different bodies in terms of their previous work. As described in the 7th chapter, the manifestation of the living force in every body is due to the superior nature of the Supreme Lord. Thus, to see one superior nature, that living force, in every body, is to see in the mode of goodness. That living entity is imperishable, although the bodies are perishable. The difference is perceived in terms of the body, because there are many forms of material existence in conditional life. Therefore, they appear to be divided. Such impersonal knowledge finally leads to self-realization. So, I think this is quite a deep verse in terms of philosophy. And if I was just to read this verse to someone on the street, it would throw them completely. I mean, if we start with what Krishna says, that knowledge by which one undivided spiritual nature is seen in all existences, undivided in the divided. Who would be able to comprehend that? Does anybody comprehend what Krishna means by undivided nature? undivided spirit.
Oneness.
Paramatma.
Oneness. Oneness is undivided. We'll just start from the basics. If I was to say that to someone on the street, can you explain oneness? What is undivided nature? Most people wouldn't understand. So the reason being they wouldn't understand is the average person lives in a world of Newtonian physics. Yeah? So Newtonian physics, we understand that if the apple falls from the tree, lands on my head, gravity is in force. Yeah? However, that apple that lands on my head is not connected to my head. There's no oneness there. We're still divided. So Newtonian physics is explaining the action of the apple falling on my head. So most people would understand this, and that's the reality that they live in. They live in an unconnected reality where they're beginning to understand the forces of nature, material nature, so gravity. So this is a problem. If you were to read the Bhagavad Gita and say, Krishna says, believe in undivided nature, you'd have an issue with that, because philosophically, your education wouldn't allow you to perceive that kind of transcendental nature, that oneness. Because due to Newtonian physics, you don't see that you are connected to that apple as well. This is further compounded by Einstein, actually. So Einstein says, there's nothing can go faster than the speed of light. So therefore, we're all limited. And that also gives a philosophical disconnection in the brain of trying to relate to something that's undivided. So a lot of people would then philosophically not go about their daily lives understanding that we're all actually connected in some form or another, because it's just not part of their education. However, there would be a certain class of people that would understand what that means. And in the 19th to 20th century, this philosophy, this mathematical understanding of quantum physics really has brought to the Western mind an understanding of a nature that we don't quite understand. Yeah, so what quantum physicists discovered is a strange property in the subatomic world called non-locality. This refers to the ability of a quantum entity, such as an individual electron, to influence another quantum particle instantaneously over any distance, despite there being no exchange of force or energy. Non-locality shatters the very foundation of physics. So the physical world that the majority of Western minds live in is actually being proved to be unfounded. Quantum physics have said that matter can no longer be considered separate. Actions do not have to have an observable cause over an observable space. Einstein's most fundamental axiom isn't correct. At a certain level of matter, things can travel faster than the speed of light. Subatomic particles have no meaning in isolation, but can be only understood in their relationships. The world at its most basic exists as a complex web of interdependent relationships, forever indivisible. So this really is quantum physicists who perhaps don't have much understanding of Vedic knowledge, really quantifying that Vedic knowledge. And this is quite important for us to understand that when we approach reading the Bhagavad Gita, we should be thinking, actually, there's a metaphysical understanding of nature that perhaps we wouldn't necessarily understand just by reading it. And this is a great boon, really, to actually say, the world, the physical world that I'm perceiving is perhaps not as real or as fundamental as perhaps I should be looking at it. There are other ways of viewing the world. Why would we do that? Why would we want to view the world as oneness or as an indivisible nature? What benefit would we get from that? Krishna says, The benefit we would get off that is that we would be living more in the mode of goodness. And living in the mode of goodness enables us to actually... Living in the mode of goodness enables us to actually live life in a better way, in a happier way, in a way that makes us more content. So if we live in the mode of ignorance or passion, you know, that will create a lot of inertia in our minds and bodies, and it will make day-to-day life a bigger struggle. So to live in the mode of goodness is a lot more beneficial. And Krishna is saying that if we can view the world as an undivided world, that everything is connected, we will actually feel more invigorated about life. So this is something perhaps we should put to the test, don't you think? Perhaps start thinking about nature, the nature, the underlying nature of everything is actually non-local. It can instantly communicate with each other. So an electron here and an electron in the nebula galaxy can instantly communicate. It needs no time or space to do that. So if we understand that actually we can then begin to perceive that our actions and reactions do affect everything on a non-local level. And it raises our awareness to perhaps be a bit more cautious in how we behave and what type of object and information we want to bring into our life. Because at an underlying level, nature is undivided. So it's interesting that the Western concept the metaphysical concept, didn't really come into fruition in terms of how the Vedas were presented until the 19th or 20th century with quantum physics. And it's very interesting that the world that we perceive is really based on an outdated method of mathematics and physics. That doesn't mean everyone doesn't view the world like that, but the majority of people. So we need to contemplate these forward-thinking sciences like physics and definitely ancient sciences like the Bhagavad Gita and begin to understand that perhaps the knowledge that Lord Sri Krishna has given in the Bhagavad Gita is very relevant today. Because if it wasn't relevant, it wouldn't ignite any interest in any of our minds. And we wouldn't be here today. And we need to understand that this knowledge is transcendental. So transcendental nature is the way the Vedas describe this undivided nature. And when we begin to contemplate that and connect it to it, it will help us become more pure in how we approach Krishna. Because if we understand that Brahman is the effulgence of Krishna, and Brahman is the first step towards self-realization, to contemplating spiritual life, Brahman is the understanding that nature is undivided, it is one. And by thinking about these things, this is what yogis do. They meditate on this oneness, that essence before the Big Bang. So everyone can think about the Big Bang. It was a big, massive explosion. Can everyone understand that? There was a point of light and it all exploded. And then, after billions of years, everything fell into place, and that we are the remnants of that explosion. So this is what spiritualists contemplate, this is what scientists contemplate. When you begin to contemplate this source of life, this source of nature, then you begin to understand that it will satiate your mind, it will make you more peaceful, more happy, because you're questioning the source from where you've come from. And this is what we need to do in life. I mean, to be a good businessman, to be a good family man, to be a good person, You need to be able to discriminate between what is right or wrong for you. Yeah? So you, to do that, then you begin to elevate yourself up and hopefully move to a position where you can be more comfortable. However, through Krishna consciousness, you understand that perhaps life is never that comfortable. Grass is never greener on the other side. So your happiness can never be satiated. It can never be content, because material nature is perishable. It's always moving. It's temporary. However, when you begin to contemplate that transcendental source before the Big Bang, the energy that fed that source, then your mind will begin to flicker with satiation of happiness, because it is going back to its original source, its original place. So, Krishna is saying that if you contemplate that, you become in the mode of goodness. Srila Prabhupada's purport gives us a nice transcendental tip. He says, as described in the seventh chapter, the manifestation of the living force in every body is due to the superior nature of the Supreme Lord. So let's delve into that a bit more, because we're understanding that there's a non-local nature. We can understand Brahman to a certain extent. We begin to contemplate it. But Srila Prabhupada said, have a look in chapter 7 to see if we can gain more of an understanding, because chapter 18 is a summary. So I've taken one text from chapter 7, text number 5. I'll just read the Sanskrit and the translation. Apariyam itas tiv anyam prakritam vidhi me param jiva bhuta mahavahu yayedam darati jagat. Translation. Besides this inferior nature, O mighty armed Arjuna, there is a superior energy of mine, which are all living entities. They are struggling with material nature and are also sustaining the universe. Now there's quite a long purport here, but I'm going to read it because it expands on this undivided nature and it helps us understand more of the Jiva Atma, which is who we are. So Srila Prabhupada in his purport kindly explains, here it is clearly mentioned that living entities belong to the superior nature or energy of the Supreme Lord. So what he's saying is we don't belong to the material nature, we belong to that undivided, non-local, transcendental nature. The inferior energy is matter manifested in different elements, namely earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. Both forms of material nature, namely gross, earth, etc., and subtle, mind, etc., are products of the inferior energy. So, Srila Prabhupada's kindly explaining that the bodies that we live in, our mind, our intelligence, is of an inferior nature to that non-local, transcendental nature. The living entities who are exploiting these inferior energies for different purposes are the superior energy of the Supreme Lord, and it is due to this energy that the entire material world functions. The cosmic manifestation has no power to act unless it is moved by the superior energy, the living entity. So Srila Prabhupada is explaining from the Vedic perception and conception, material nature is in fact inert, it's dull, it has no life force in it. It's a superior energy, the transcendental energy, that gives it that life force. Energies are always controlled by the energetic, and therefore living entities are always controlled by the Lord. They have no independent existence. They are never equally powerful as unintelligent men think. The distinction between the living entities and the Lord is described in Srimad Bhagavatam as follows, 1087.30. I'll just read the English translation. O Supreme Eternal, if the embodied living entities were eternal and all-pervading like you, then they would not be under your control. So, if we were Krishna, Krishna wouldn't be able to control us. So if we're jiva atmas, subatomic fragmental portions, particles of Krishna, then we would be under his control if he is infinite. Yeah? But if the living entities are accepted as minute energies of your lordship, then they are at once subject to your supreme control. Therefore, real liberation entails surrender by the living entities to your control, and that surrender will make them happy. So if our constitutional position of superior energy is transcendental, and we understand that position, that we're not God, we are a fragmented portion, then surrendering to Krishna will actually make us happy, because we're then surrendering to our true nature. Therefore, men with limited knowledge who advocate the monistic theory that God and the living entities are equal in all respects are actually misleading themselves and others. So Krishna says that men that contemplate the undivided nature are in the mode of goodness. So men that contemplate are in the mode of goodness. But here, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's taken a step more. It's saying, no, if we contemplate that not just the undivided nature, that we are actually minute energies of that undivided nature, the same quality. So our soul is made up of the same quality of that undivided nature, but it's minute, it's not infinite. If we can understand that that's our constitutional position, we're then going on to transcendental knowledge, which is above the mode of goodness. This is nirguna. This is not of the modes of material nature. So that is a quote from the Srimad Bhagavatam to help you understand that. Although we're made up of that superior energy, we're only minute. We have minute free will and independence. The Supreme Lord Krishna is the only controller, and all living entities are controlled by him. These living entities are his superior energy because the quality of their existence is one and the same with the Supreme, but they are never equal to the Lord in quantity of power. So although the quality of our souls is the same as Krishna, the quantity of the power contained within him is not contained within us. While exploiting the gross and subtle inferior energy, matter, the superior energy, the living entity, forgets its real spiritual mind and intelligence. This forgetfulness is due to the influence of matter upon the living entity. But when the living entity becomes free from the illusion of the illusory material energy, he attains the stage called mukti, or liberation. So, if we contemplate this undivided nature, this non-locality, this nature that we can't perceive without intelligence, then we understand that in the Vedas and in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that this undivided nature is Brahman, one. It's transcendental. If we begin to contemplate that, we become liberated from material nature. And this is a good place to be, because then we won't have to be swayed so much by material nature. And by doing this, we are raising our intelligence and understanding of life. So if our understanding of life is at a Newtonian level or an Einstein level of physical understanding, our world is built up like this, and this is the parameters. A quantum physicist is saying, no, that's not the parameters. This is a world that really we can perceive from a quantum angle. And they're saying it's all non-local. Their intelligence is far higher than the way that Newton and Einstein was perceiving in the world. And we should aspire to gain more and more knowledge to help us live in the world in a more comfortable way, and also to understand why we're here, why we're suffering, why the modes of material nature. But in the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, the living entity becomes free from the influence of the illusory material energy. He attains a stage called mukti, or liberation, when he understands this transcendental nature. So to continue this, it says, the false ego, under the influence of material illusion, thinks, I am matter, and material acquisitions are mine. His actual position is realized when he is liberated from all material ideas. Including the conception of his becoming one in all respects with God. Therefore, one may conclude that the Gita confirms the living entity to be only one of the multi-energies of Krishna. And when this energy is freed from material contamination, it becomes fully Krishna-conscious or liberated. So when we read the Bhagavad Gita, this is the knowledge that's contained within it. It's very deep metaphysical knowledge, but it actually helps alleviate us from our mundane perception of the world, that material nature is just made of matter, and that's all we are. And when we die, material nature goes back. So I hope that hasn't gone too deep for anybody. Has anyone got any questions on any points that I brought up today? Is there anything that you think you could incorporate into your life, or just as you go outside, that will help you remember the points that we brought up? What do you think Krishna means by the word undivided spiritual nature? This point, the quality of our soul is the same as Krishna, always gives me great inspiration. What does that mean? You know, if Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he revealed himself in the Bhagavad Gita. When Arjuna saw his universal form, he saw all infinite reality within him, contained within him. And our soul is the same quality. So this is a thought that really can inspire anybody. For me, this will give anybody real liberation. Real liberation is internal liberation. Liberation of the mind, that you're not always chasing after sense gratification of what you think your bodily desires are. And when you contemplate the soul and the quality of the soul, it will take you on a journey that you don't quite expect, because the journey is a positive, reaffirming one. This is why I brought in quantum physics, because when you study the soul, you really are studying subatomic particles. And who thinks about that in their everyday life? Why would that give you inspiration if you don't like maths, if you don't like thinking academically? But no, that's not the case. You know, just to understand that the particle of existence that upholds your reality is the same quality as Krishna's. You know, that will really help you step away from the normal life that you live. If you're watching TV, you've got family life, business life. It's one of those questions where you go, hang on a minute. I need to think about that one, because like, that's not something I've ever thought about. What is my soul? What is the quality of the soul? Yeah, so this is a knowledge that Krishna's given 5,000 years ago, and the West, with all its advancements, is only catching up with a language that can describe that knowledge. So really, that's quite a far out thing, isn't it? That 2,000 years of history, it's only with quantum physics that actually Western scientists are saying, yeah, I think we can start to have a terminology where we can understand the Vedas. And really, in a lot of ways, that is how they're thinking. Because if you understand that Oppenheimer, the great physicist that created the atom bomb, what was the one word, a thing he said after the first atom bomb was exploded. And now I have become death. He quoted the Bhagavad Gita. Why would he quote the Bhagavad Gita? Because he's gained his knowledge from there, his inspiration of how to reduce nature to a fine point, an atomic point. So we should really treasure the Bhagavad Gita as a great gift of knowledge that we wouldn't always come in contact with. And this is why it's so wonderful to come to the temple, because there is an avenue, a pathway of really enjoying the highest knowledge at the most enjoyable form. And what form is that? We chant, we sing, we dance, yeah? And we're dancing, and we have all of this wonderful knowledge. We have an avenue to contemplate ways of thinking that wouldn't be in our jurisdiction, in our everyday life. And this is something we should really treasure and say, actually, you know, if I actually really think about what is the soul, what's the quality of the soul, what is undivided nature, non-locality in quantum physics, or Brahman, transcendental nature. These are things that will really stop you. They will bamboozle you. Yeah, they'll bamboozle the average person. If you went to the average person in the street and said, "Can you describe non-locality?" What would they say? No. But they wouldn't say, "Go away, you're religious. I don't really want to understand religion." But Krishna consciousness is more than just a religion where we say, "Oh, just believe in Krishna, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, just have faith. Krishna's on the altar, we get to see him every day. Just believe he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead." No, Srila Prabhupada's given us more than that. The Vedas are much more technical than saying, you know, "Come to our temple, chant Hare Krishna, and you'll be in bliss, and just know Sri Krishna's there, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead." No, if you read the Bhagavad Gita and study it, just read it from back to back, you'll have a change of consciousness, without doubt. Why did Einstein read the Bhagavad Gita? Because he had a change of consciousness. He understood that the knowledge contained in it helped him. Yeah? Why was Newton? Newton, he didn't read the Bhagavad Gita, but he was a Christian. Yeah? So a lot of sciences, we have to understand that science and metaphysics, science originally was there to prove that God existed. It lost its way a bit, I think. Yeah? But through losing its way, through quantum physics, it's now finding its way. Although it's not describing it in that way, but through the Vedas, we can perceive that this is a knowledge that's being represented. Yeah? It's quite...
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Free will, maybe it is out of context, but I have some confusion regarding free will. Mm-hmm. So when something good happens, we say that God is the doer. When we go in the deviated path, some bad doing, then we say that it's our free will that is making us do all the things. So it's not confusing. Something good happens, that everything in destiny and the God and the karma, but bad happens, we just blame our free will for that.
Sure, I can understand what you mean. And whenever this subject comes up, I think the best way to understand it is, there's a small analogy. Man proposes, God disposes. Yeah? So it is within our nature to always desire. So this is one of the symptoms of the soul. One of the qualities of the soul is that it desires. Yeah? It desires all of these things. So we need to purify our desires. And this is one of the main teachings of Krishna consciousness, is that we don't try to negate desire. We don't say the whole world is false. Just as science, quantum physics would prove the whole world is false. Do not believe, you know, this isn't really here. But this is a I think it's called a neti-neti philosophy. It tries to negate our existence. Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, doesn't do that. It tries to embrace our existence. It acknowledges that actually one of the symptoms of the jiva-atma, of the living entity, is desire. And we need to purify that desire so that it doesn't come back and hit us on the back of the head and say, you know, that wasn't quite a good desire. Here's your karmic comeuppance. Yeah? So this is one thing that we should try to understand is free will is there because we are jiva atmas. Yeah, and we can't deny that. But we shouldn't get locked down in karma. We shouldn't be so fanatical about that. What we should try to do is try to elevate our consciousness so that we can have, I think it's vikarma or ikarma. So it's null karma. This is what Krishna consciousness does. And what that means is that, as I was describing before, if you contemplate transcendental nature, as Krishna says, undivided spiritual nature, then we are watering the root. Yeah, we are watering the root through bhakti yoga, through devotion. So therefore, when we perform bhakti yoga and our, everything that we do, instead of it being for ourselves, for sense gratification, we make it an offering to Krishna, we then make nil karma, because we are doing transcendental actions. So this is the best thing we should try to do. We can't escape that we're in the material world, but let's make it a nil, a contra. Let's perform all of our actions for Krishna, then we won't get the karma from them. Does that help?
Our activities.
Exactly. Is there any other?
Just regarding the previous question, when you said when something good happens, we give it credit to God. Mm-hmm. Isn't that to practice gratitude as a part of our?
That is, and it's a good way to learn self-control.
And similarly, when something bad happens, for the practice of responsibility.
Yeah, to take responsibility. So, what if we're trying to create equilibrium in our minds? Equilibrium means a balance. So a balance means we shouldn't get too happy when things work out our way, and we shouldn't be too sad when things don't. We should be aware of what we're doing. So we should understand that if we're happy, we've proposed to do that, and we've done the right actions to create the environment that induces that happiness. If we're unhappy, then perhaps we should try to contemplate what perhaps our actions took us to the place where we weren't happy, and then try and do something to fix it. And by offering the good things to Krishna and taking responsibility for the bad things, we can then begin to balance out our emotions. Because that's what we want to try and do. We want to try and be more fixed and steady in how we behave. And this gives us lots of benefits. If you're a clean, sober person, you can get along in life. You know, you wake up every day, life isn't that bad, you can get along. If you're not so clean and sober, it becomes a bit more difficult. So by doing this, we begin to learn that our natural state is actually quite a happy, balanced one, if we can do that. Yeah?
So the Prabhupada in the Shastra also says that to happen anything, two things are required. One is one's desire to do something, another is sanctioned by the Supreme Lord. Unless both, we can desire many things, but it is not possible that it will happen.
Exactly.
And unless it is sanctioned.
Mm-hmm.
So, and whatever it desire, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I'm not involved in anything.
No. So
whatever do, I'm giving exactly whatever.
So Krishna's impartial,
totally
because
impartial.
He's transcendental nature. He's not of the material nature. So this is a good way to understand the Paramatma, which a lot of people have difficulty with, is that the Paramatma creates our local experience. Yeah. So we're as quantum physicists will say, we are the conscious observer. So we desire, it consciously happens, but there's rules and regulations around that, and the Paramatma sanctions that. But this is the difference. The Paramatma, Krishna, is transcendental. He's not of the material nature. So he can never be affected by it, yeah? But he can understand the rules and regulations behind it. So therefore, he can sanction it, but he doesn't become affected. Yeah. Srila Prabhupada also describes that when the Paramatma does this, then it's like a judge making a decision. If you go to court and a judge makes a decision, he's impartial to that decision. He's only following the law. So nature has its own laws. So the Paramatma then ensures that those laws are followed through.
But here judgment can be also wrong. Not because depending on the proof, somebody is angry there, the judgment may, but that not in the
course,
but his judgment is 100%.
Yeah, that's
because he is always here,
exactly.
And he always knows what we have done.
Mm-hmm.
There are two things, what we are accepted, what we are doing, two persons know. I am doing, I know, and he knows.
Yeah.
He is everybody. So we can cheat others, people can cheat individuals, but nobody can teach him.
So to understand this point, if we go back to non-locality in quantum physics, this is when a certain level of matter can travel faster than the speed of light. So what we're saying is that an individual electron to influence another quantum particle instantaneously over any distance, despite there being no exchange, so impartial of force or energy. So Krishna's within everything. He can instantly communicate to himself, yeah, with no exchange of energy or force. Okay? So this is an impartial nature. And this is how we can begin to contemplate what is understood by these transcendental topics and how this comes into play. So I think we'll leave it there for today, and I thank you all for attending the class, and
Krishna. Krishna, 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 Krishna.